And we're back, season 6 of Record of Change, and it's almost a whole new podcast. Well, the team is the same, but my voice might sound new to you. I mostly worked in the background in the past. The same is true for Nimish. Hi, Nimish.
Hey, Thomas. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Just...
So this season, we thought we'd focus on one topic per episode. So what we're doing is we're documenting how various things and processes and ideas and just about everything in the world has changed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And we try to find some surprising angles, and we'll explore this new reality together with you, our listeners. Thanks for joining us. And Nimish, what topic did you choose for this first episode of our new season?
So I chose the topic of technology because, I mean, I am a technology journalist by profession, and that's something that always attracts me. And I just wanted to show how technology can play out differently in the developed world and the developing world. So here in the global north, the pandemic led to an increase in digitalization, whereas on the other side of the fence, you have a global south country like India, where digitalization is pretty advanced. But at the same time, digital literacy is not that much. And that leads to a lot of issues like fake news, misinformation, and spread of propaganda. So I just wanted to sort of use technology in the context of the pandemic to show how it can be used for good, as well as how it can lead to unintended consequences as well.
Yeah. So yeah, we're comparing Germany and India, and you recorded interviews with two experts. And I join you here as a co-host because I'm also a technology journalist. So we are the two geeks on the Record of Change team. and I find it super fascinating what technology has, how our perception of technology has changed through the pandemic. Because I'm German and I live in the United States. So to add another perspective to this, for example, here, you know, technology often comes in this digital age from Silicon Valley, and people often feel like Silicon Valley helps solve us all of the problems in the world, right? That's the attitude there. And with this pandemic, early on, I think Apple and Google both started integrating this technology for contact tracing into their phone operating systems. And we thought that would be the big thing, right? But in the end, I don't know if it had a big impact, at least here in the States. I mean, every state of the United States has its own app, or sometimes a few states collaborate and they're compatible. But there's one app for the state of New York where I live that you have to use for contact tracing. But it has not been marketed well, and almost nobody uses it, while in Germany, there's a lot of talk to this day about this. What's it called?
It's called the CoronaVan app.
CoronaVan app. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So there, Germany was at the forefront, and I think it actually helped prevent a lot of cases in Germany. But here, this technology side of the pandemic, I didn't really see it play out. But yeah, Nimish, what did you find out about digitalization in Germany?
Well, I already had some experience with digitization and how it's used in Germany. So, for instance, when I was doing my city registration,
you live in Berlin, right?
I live in Berlin now. Yeah. So I had moved to Berlin in March this year, and I was going to register myself at the city registration office. But on the day I had got my appointment, which is super difficult to get, you get there's a 6-month, 7-month waiting. The day I had gone to get my appointment, the systems were not working and they didn't have a plan B. And I was like really surprised, why couldn't someone just take note down my details in their machines, and then when systems came up online, it could be uploaded. And, it just made me think back about in India, we always have like a plan B, C, D, E, when it comes to digitization. And in the past, I have reported about this tech divide between Germany and India in some of my stories. But this time with the pandemic, it was a lot more interesting to look at it with fresh eyes. Mm-hmm.
So you wanted to find out more, obviously, and talk to someone. Tell us about who you met.
Yes. So the reason I had read one story earlier this year about how Germany was still using fax machines. The German health authorities were using fax machines to transmit COVID results. And then those fax results were manually entered into machines. And I just found that really strange. So, I wanted to dig deeper into, why this is. And I also, during my research, I also found that a lot of the Germany's internet infrastructure is still very, very copper heavy. And fiber optics is still going at a very, very slow pace. Because if you want to dig a hole in the earth, you have to get hundreds of permissions, So there are a lot of these roadblocks. But because of the pandemic, a lot of these things got sped up. And I actually got a chance to speak to Mr. Alexander Raber, who's the managing director of ECO, which is the Association of Internet Industries here in Berlin. So let's listen into the interview.
Yes, and we are recording this episode while the new government in Germany is still forming. It's not in place yet, but that might have changed once this episode comes out. So keep that in mind while listening. And I find it really interesting that he also suggests that his organization is kind of advising the new government on how to deal with digitalization. So yeah, here's the interview.
My name is Alexander Rabe. I'm the managing director of ECO, the Association of the Internet Industry. The association was founded over 25 years ago, and that was a time in Germany where digitalization was not actually on the top of the agenda.
And could you tell us briefly how ECO, works in the digitalization efforts with the German government, or do you work independently of the government?
Our work is pretty typical, like the work of any other association also. We are sitting here in Berlin in the middle of the heart of the politicians' decisions. Meanwhile, the coalition discussions are going on, and even the last weeks were for us pretty intensive work as an association, because we have, of course, a lot of positions. We call that the Internet Politische Agenda. So there we find within 20 pages all the important topics we believe the politicians in Germany should focus on to transform economic and society in a good way.
Could you tell us where Germany stands when it comes to digitalization?
Well, this is a question I would love to answer, we are a leading country in that point, but all the statistics you've probably read, they show us that Germany has made some mistakes in the last centuries, in the last decades, because beginning from the digital infrastructures like fiber, we decided in the early 80s that we just want to go on with copper connections. And this is something we still in the year 2021 have to work on to transform the layer of the digital infrastructure. On the one hand. On the other hand, we see nowadays also connected to digital infrastructure, the whole situation with data centers. We are a shareholder of DKIX, and this is in Frankfurt, means that there is a data center hub in Europe, actually the biggest one. It's a really good feature we have in Germany. This is always connected within the question, where is your data hosted? Where is it? And this is a very physical answer afterwards you can give. And this is something we still have to get into the mind of the politician and the leaders in this area.
How do you think the pandemic affected efforts towards digitalization? Do you think it increased digitalization, or do you think it had no effect?
Of course it had an effect, because everyone who was discussing if digitalization makes sense realized that that was, meanwhile, the lockdown we had in Germany, the only way to keep on running the economic or the education or even the communication systems within the society. Without that, we would have really seen that the situation could have been much worse than it was. But we've also recognized But maybe that's also a positive effect, that a lot of things hasn't been transformed as they could have been. For example, education. For example, the whole situation with the health system in Germany. But a lot of mindset change happened. And I think it's now pretty important not just to go back to normal and to print out your papers again, but to keep that experience in mind and try to change your daily life nowadays in all these areas I mentioned already. This will be something we should motivate. Yeah, let's put it like that.
I had read reports about how the German health authorities were still using fax machines till January 2021 for recording COVID test results, and then those results were entered manually into computers. Why do you think there is such a heavy reliance on paper-based administrative work in Germany?
Why do you think this is something which happened like in the past? It still happens right now. This is something maybe the pressure was not high enough to transform different systems because the economic situation was in the last years pretty good. And I mean, the politician system is, I think, a system which is not known for pretty innovative and to change itself and to change the processes. This is something we experience now since over 5 years, because we identified one of the big problems are the different responsibilities in the politician area to decide about how to digitalize and what is to digitalize and maybe what not. So for us, it's pretty important to have something like a Ministry for Digitalization in Germany. And it's not that the others shouldn't go on with the digital transformation, but there has to be one role which is coordinating a consistent politician decision, who is offering a digital agenda, which implicates that you know what you're doing. For example, IT security, you know, for everyone, it's clear to trust in a system, we have to be sure it has to be secure. But on the other hand, we know that, for example, the executive, the police, for example, should have access to some chats or telephone calls to identify terrorists or the criminals. And to get that together, to be on the one hand a secure IT system, but on the other hand find ways to transfer also the police work to the 21st century, this is something you should bring together and not acting on completely different sides. And at the end, you're just coming to us, to the digital economy, and we have to decide then, okay, which of your requests is now more prior? Should we be, for example, encryption place number one in the world, or should we implement backdoors? So please, dear government, get yourself together, find a consistent way, and in the best way, you find a Europe way.
Going back to your point about having a digital ministry and a central authority to give these digital rules. We have seen over the last year how the pandemic regulations, because of the federal structure of Germany, even you can't just have a top-down approach. Every state decides its own rules and regulations. So how do you think, when it comes to digitalization, that will play out? Isn't it against the German way of doing things, where you have one central authority who gives orders and the states have to just follow it?
Of course. And that's the reason why there are so many voices against this idea. Because you have to change. You have to change the processes, the way you think, the way you act, the way you design. But you mentioned the federal system in Germany. And if you have a look of the data protection rules we have in Europe, that's great. We have a framework for 27 states in Europe. But in Germany, we have 16 different interpretations of that. If you live in Bavaria or in Berlin, that makes a difference in the interpretation of the European framework. And this is actually something, it's not a good idea. And therefore, of course, the government also has to change the way they decide on the table. This is right now the best moment to get this change into reality, because now in this coalition talks, you decide how to work in the next 4 years. And it's open, and it's for the majority, for the government afterwards, possible to change rules, which have been always like that. And I think to get into the rhythm of the speed of digitalization, the politician decision processes have also to change. Yeah.
Do you think with the new regime coming in after the Merkel administration, is digitalization a very important agenda? Because, you know, we saw like after the July floods, the agendas for all parties just changed to climate change, which is important, of course. But digitalization wasn't something that was, you know, heard in the top priority. So what's your perspective on how the next coalition will play out when it comes to digitalization?
Personal for me, you can't fight the climate change without digital technologies. The positive impact of digitalization, if you use it for the right things as a tool, I truly and deeply believe that every government, not just the German government, should integrate digitalization as a solution for all these different tasks they are in front of us now. It's not just the climate change. It's probably one of the biggest challenges we are facing, but we also have the demographic change in Europe. And we see in the pandemic situation, it's not always guaranteed that for every bed in a hospital, there is a person who can help you. If you just get to all these areas of our society and economy, you will see there is no place left without digital support. And I think that's good, but this brings the duty for all the responsibility leaders in a government to integrate these new technology in their solution approaches.
And also, have you noticed the public's approach towards digitalization and all? Because like you mentioned about the demographics, a majority of the population of Germany is quite on the older side. And it's not very easy for them to get acquainted with digital tools. During the pandemic, do you think that there's been a shift in that?
Definitely. We've seen the numbers of people over 60 years old who are using e-commerce offers, for example, they increased. And actually, maybe not everyone who is 70 or 18 is able to upload a TikTok video, but maybe that's also not the main reason to get into the internet.
And do you see this momentum towards digitalization continuing in a post-COVID Germany?
Yes. There's no time to waste anymore. We wasted a lot of time in the last decades in asking ourselves if it's maybe going on with this internet stuff. I think we found the answer. And I think we found that the whole future of our generations is dependent. And I mean, you know, I have three children. I know that this is the future, and these three different children have three different approaches how they use digitalization. And this is actually what I mean. It's not just the internet and the digitalization. It's what we make out of it. We as human beings have the power to decide if this technology is maybe just used for getting some bitcoins with a lot of energy lost, or if we use the same technology in saving our planet and giving us a better future.
Could you tell me a personal story or any instance where this increased digitalization during the pandemic was helpful to you?
I have no idea where to start and where to end, actually. I mean, for our association, we started in March 2020 with the mobile work concept. We discussed, I think, 2 years before if and how we should implement more mobile work to the employees. And then from one day to the other, we just did it. And we've seen it works. It still works. And for us, it's clear we want to keep on this experience that people can work from all areas in the world, and we find some culture to get together again and to solve the problems for the projects we are in. And that bring a lot of dynamic into our change process as an association with our employees, for example.
You mentioned at the start about the infrastructure issues, you know, so internet issues is a big topic of debate in Germany, in Berlin. Like certain parts of Berlin, you just don't get good internet connection. Do you see that changing in the near future? Because like you mentioned, the infrastructure is already laid out. It's very copper heavy and, you know, changing that into fiber, how long do you think that's going to take, the transformation?
We're at a point where this change of copper to fiber is connected to real life problems. You know, to dig a hole into the earth, you need people for, and the capacity we need, it's limited. So I think we will come to some natural frontiers right now concerning the speed of transformation in this case. There's one thing we could change. In Germany, a lot of administration work is done before someone is allowed to dig a hole into the earth. Maybe this is something we can really speed up. This should be definitely possible. But on the other hand, we're still missing people who are digging afterwards this hole for this new fiber connection. Sounds funny, but it's really a serious problem right now. When you ask me how fast can this transformation come up now, we should have started 30 years before.
Thanks, Nimish, for this interview. I found it really interesting. And I mean, to your last question, yeah, I think, of course, digitalization will now continue in Germany. But I'm also a little bit skeptical because I hear a lot about companies, for example, trying to end home office options again, right? And I see a lot about universities struggling with the question, how much remote learning and teaching do they want to allow in the future? So there's still some debate around this, and it's certainly not going to go full digital anytime soon. And I mean, sure, we want some personal interaction too.
Yes, but I think we are probably looking at the number of cases that are rising in Germany at the moment. You know, I think things are going to go back to remote, at least for a short period till the wave comes down. Because I remember like a couple of months ago, all the physical events were back, and you know, I attended a few technology events as well in person, and it was a very good experience meeting people in person and networking and all. But since the last week, I've been seeing whichever physical events were scheduled, they have all been like, you know, okay, we are postponing this because of the rising corona cases, and So I think it's going to come back. Just crazy.
But the question I think is, what of this will stick for the time after the pandemic, if we ever get there? So will we have still hybrid conferences where people can attend in person and can attend virtually? Yeah, I think that's still for us to figure out.
Yeah.
And so how does this compare to India? I don't know if it's even comparable at all.
Well, India, unlike in Germany and a lot of Western nations, a large part of the population, their first access to internet was through their mobile phones. It wasn't through their PC or a laptop or something like that. So people just went from no internet to 4G internet in no time. Mm-hmm. And I think it just made sense for the government to also, you know, digitize rapidly. And that's why now you have a lot of the records are, you know, stored in government servers and all. Of course, that comes with its own set of issues, because there have been cases where, you know, data has been hacked into, people's privacy has been, you know, played hard and fast with. So there are disadvantages of that as well. And that is precisely what I wanted to explore with my next interviewee, who is Dr. Sumaya Sheikh.
Can you tell us more about her?
So Dr. Sumaya Sheikh, I first came to know about her. So there is this very famous fact-checking website in India called Alt News. And they came into existence because of the rapid spread of digitization. There was also a huge spread of fake news in India, you know. So they would basically just debunk all the fake news that is out there. And a part of this website was called Alt News Science, where they looked specifically at science-based misinformation. And Dr. Sumaya Sheikh is the editor who, you know, runs this science department. Mm-hmm. And by profession, she's not a journalist. She is a neuroscientist with a PhD, and she's currently a postdoc fellow in Sweden.
Great. Yeah, I'm curious. I can't wait to hear what she has to say. And yes. Maybe we should add that we had some trouble recording this interview, so some sections had to be re-recorded, so bear with us.
Hello, Dr. Soumaya Sheikh. A very warm welcome on Record of Change.
Thank you, Nimish, for this opportunity.
First of all, I'd like to start off by asking you about your journey from neuroscience to fact-checking for alt new science. Could you elaborate on that?
I've been into science fallacies and hoaxes since a long time. It was way back in my undergraduate. I think it was in my second year of medical science. And when I wanted to do research, I was interested in breast cancer because I thought I had the gene for it. My auntie had it. My mother is actually still going through her chemotherapy. So I was pretty interested in doing research for cancer. So I did go to somebody who was doing some therapeutics and I said, you know, I want to do some research, you know, analyze the data. That was my summer project. And it turned out to be, it was a bit of acupuncture and some alternative medicine. So I started analyzing the data and I realized there were some problems in the data. And I walked up to the professor and I asked her, well, the people who received acupuncture for breast cancer, pain due to the chemotherapy, why are they showing a reduced pain after acupuncture than the actual placebo? I realized this is something I needed to talk about later in the year, because if we are investing so much money in research into real treatments, vaccines, and therapies, and if just sheer propaganda is taking all of that out and reducing people's, not just the life expectancy, but also the way that medicine is treated now, or any belief, any belief system could be a part of this. Any information is treated now. If you're going to give something that simple, easily acceptable, palatable, and it's going to make those claims as wide as treating cancer and treating diabetes, and treating diabetes is not actually real because you have to manage diabetes. I am totally open to having new herbs being tested, but tested like the way it should be for any other drug, and not say, oh, this is a part of Ayurveda or homeopathy or whatever the belief system is, or Chinese therapy. And Chinese and Indian therapies, Ayurveda, are very much overlapping. So that was my journey, and I realized what a disservice it was for the society to lean onto these things. And obviously the pandemic came and everything became very real. People started drinking bleach because of what Trump said. And everybody thought they were protected because of a homeopathic pill. There were the other problems from the government itself, where the government was saying things like, oh, Indians are not going to get this because we are genetically immune. Well, guess what? Before the second wave, that was. And then I had to go through what is different in Indians, and that's not true. It was based on a very false kind of thinly bound thread where, you know, there were different cell expression in South Asian population, but it wasn't going to make us immune to infections. We were as susceptible and vulnerable as anybody else, and we saw that in the second wave. So, but if we're not looking at this problem, which more than half of the population in India is believing into, we're really doing a disservice to even the actual science. And not many public scientists came out and talked about it back then. So I think I was one of the first ones to do these things. I really wanted to take this up while I was doing my original research, which is in neuroscience. And now it's kind of overlap a little bit.
Dr. Sheikh, could you tell me a personal story where, you know, India's increased digitization and the fact that everyone has access to cheap mobile internet plans has been a matter of concern for you?
I have been talking about it quite a bit around me, and most of the people around me are quite educated about the hoaxes that come around on the internet. My mother, for example, recently when she had cancer, like 2 years ago, every single person in the family would send her these things that this is way to cure your cancer, or that is the way to cure your cancer. And even seeing how chemotherapy can do to you and what it can do to you, it is you feel pretty terrible. It really takes you down because it's killing every cell of the body that's growing fast, including your hair, everything. The cancer cells grow fast, and that's why they're killed. So it doesn't differentiate between cancer and non-cancerous cells. It is just killing the fast growing cells in your body. So you feel horrible obviously some of your cells are dying, or a lot of them. And what you're seeing is not a betterment in your health. What you're seeing is totally the opposite of it. And it's very easy to get swayed by cheaper, natural, not so side effect causing therapies. But I think she understood what was the hoax and what was not, that stuff that came around on the internet.
Dr. Sheikh, when you look at India, a lot of people have access to mobile phones and internet. But at the same time, there is a lack of digital literacy and education around it. So what's your take on that?
Definitely the digital literacy, the internet literacy is one of the worst in India. Everybody has an access. And it doesn't coincide with the literacy otherwise, you know, and that is our problem. So if you look at our parents' generation, if they're in their 60s and stuff, they are educated. They know what is happening. They can read, they can understand and comprehend information. But because they don't understand this complex way of algorithms and, you know, what machine learning does and what all these, like, you know, they've just heard these terminologies and they have no idea how these things work. I mean, it's difficult to educate those people, I can understand. But what we need to do is educate people who are still in their working lives, who are still holding positions, and also people who are in schools right now. Like, so while they're still young, we want to develop that kind of critical thinking towards this, at least, towards the problems around internet. And then when they get to vote, they understand the fallacies around these things.
Scientific temperament in India is a matter of debate. And it gets especially worrying when politicians and influential people actually go out and endorse pseudoscience. In that context, Dr. Sheikh, how easy or difficult is it for you to convince someone who are forwarding fake messages which have scientifically wrong facts? How do you, you know, through your work in alt news science, convince them to maybe even consider fact-checking or nudge them in that direction?
Because our country, and I would say it's not my country on the paper, but I'm ethnically Indian, so it's so polarized. It's so split in divisive kind of ideologies. And people really, you know, because if they agree with government on one thing, they would agree with everything else that the government is saying. And they'll be like, oh, because they can't go wrong. And this is because it's a part of our culture. It's a part of our heritage. Ayurveda could never be wrong. But see it this way, like COVID was never introduced when Ayurvedic stuff came out. So a lot of Ayurveda practitioners are coming out and saying that, look, what you guys are doing is wrong. It's in the name of business. It's not in the name of real Ayurvedic science. You don't have to be a low-income country or someone who is a lot less in terms of digital literacy. I mean, UK saw some of those people where they went and burned the 5G towers, the mobile phone towers. And India has like none of those things, and you know, more population, and you know, there's all and lack of digital literacy to a lot more extent than any of these countries have. So yes, we're judging India because we work on India, but I think we should not be too quick to judge. One of the other aspects of this is that people know how terrible pharmaceutical companies and clinicians have been. Also, some clinicians, not all of them, but a lot of them do get to have private practicing clinics, and they kind of generate a lot of private income. And that is obviously a conflict of interest. So healthcare should not be on a private practice. It should, that because of that conflict of interest, you cannot trust the clinician to do the right thing for you.
Dr. Sheikh, could you tell us about a few bizarre stories that you may have come across last year when the pandemic was on in India?
I think there were so many of them. I think the first one would be that the very first lockdown happened for 12 hours and it was on a Sunday, and people thought that that would eliminate COVID completely, because COVID virus, the SARS-CoV-2, is actually killed by sunlight, which is true. It is killed by sunlight. Any virus would be killed if it's just left out there open, you know. Most of these virus would be killed, not any, but... So that 12-hour period, everybody thought that this is going to happen. Nevertheless, that did not work out. Then came the bizarre vibrations from beating pots and pans and plates outside. And those bizarre vibrations had a specific frequency of sound, and all of this would do to charge the particles in the air, and it would kill the virus for sure. No, it didn't work out either. And I think, again, I don't want to blame everybody, because if I was a majoritarian person in Nazi Germany, and if I was a white Christian man, not poor, but middle class, struggling hand to mouth, and if I was living under the propaganda of the Nazis, I would also absorb the propaganda, and I would also be a part of it. Like, don't kid yourself, and don't pretend that you would not. You would absolutely be that person, you know. We shouldn't forget how challenging these things are for a regular population. So I know I'm comparing the extremes here. I'm comparing Nazi propaganda to anti-science stuff. But at the end of the day, it's not believing data. It's not believing what is real. It's believing the fallacies. Anti-science stuff is pretty close to far-right stuff. We've seen this all over the world during the pandemic as well.
You mentioned about your research on social media tools. Could you tell us how these social media sites can play out adversely or have real-life consequences if not used mindfully?
So pandemic's just the one aspect of it. I mean, I look at misinformation in health and medicine, but I also look at viral misinformation that can damage people's lives directly, like violence, you know, like something, violence on the society that happens on the street. So there are like many aspects to create the society that people have created in India. One aspect of it is that you keep people on the edge all the time. There is economic insecurity. There's, you know, other types of fears that are instilled on a daily basis. And then you add this kind of like highly emotive content in the mix and make sure the people consume that on a very regular basis. And then when you add propaganda to it, which comes through WhatsApp, and if it reaches enough number of people, you're creating a mass turning on of a switch. So one person switches it on in their heads and instantly decides that, oh, this is the right time to do something about all that brewing emotion in your head that is keeping you on the edge. This is the time to fall off the edge. And you've turned that switch on. And when you do that for a lot of people at the same time, and then you amplify it online, we know a lot of the far right people start a trend every morning at, say, 8, 11, 5. So they have like specific timings when they release hashtags, and they have their toolkits, which is so not like, it's not something that people would understand. And that hashtags get amplified, and they'll say that, oh, it's gone 200,000, you know, we need to get it to 500,000, and they'll keep talking about it. And in those closed groups, these conversations happen. And if there are, say, 30,000 people in those closed groups, they're not 30,000 inactive people. These are, majority of them are actively doing stuff. So, you know, the followers or the consumers are a different group. And then if you have, say, 30,000 active people working towards generating that hashtag and outrage, and then people consuming that on the street, some are going to be in their living rooms and some are going to be like radical social workers and like, let's take it into the hand, people on the edge. They fall off the edge, come together, organize something, and boom, you have it.
You mentioned about alternative therapies in India, and a lot of politicians and influential people openly endorse them. So how does a regular person verify if these claims are indeed correct?
For a normal person, I would say, think about the impact of this. B, think about what's the emotion it's causing. And is it too good to be true? Is it that kind of a message that is, oh, there is a simple herb in your kitchen that is going to cure cancer that you had no idea about? Something along those lines. It is very likely that it is not true. What you do is then go and speak either to an expert or somebody who's more accessible, who understands something, and not just take their word for it. Ask them to explain whys and whats. So you really have to go out and learn all by yourself. The other thing that you could do is go on the internet, paste in a couple of things, but then you have to be really wary of the websites that you visit. So All New Science is a very trademark kind of way of doing fact checks. What we publish takes weeks, if not months, to go through. We really go through the literature, and what we believe is this slow output, which is very rare, because if something's trending, almost instantly or the same night, you'll have people talking about it on debates and TV shows and stuff. And this is not how science is supposed to work. An expert is supposed to go over, think over, ponder, which takes a long period of time. And our articles are one of those that are longer lasting. They're not just, oh, we produce something today and it has no value tomorrow.
Do you think things will stay the same when it comes to digital literacy, or do you see things changing in the near future?
Well, the younger generation is definitely not going to be the same. See, things are never static. I really have a lot of hope, and that's why I'm doing this work. I really believe that things are never constant. Things always change. And if not in the next 10 years, in the next 20 years, things will definitely change. Because that is how we progress, right? Everybody changes. And I have a lot of belief in the young people now who are exposed to the internet. And one of the things I do want to do is just instill some aspect of critical thinking in them. If that kind of population comes out, and if children in school understand, you know, we have a really good, in at least middle class, upper middle class, we have a good education rate. Everybody's at least has an undergrad or a master's in like big cities, and, you know, people who can at least afford. Not as much, we can get more, but it's still quite a bit. And the sad part is that those people who go to universities are not equipped to understand these things. And schools and colleges are really the perfect way to have critical thinking instilled. And if these things really take off in the rest of the country, I have a lot of hope for the future. And I don't think things are going to be the same.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Somaya Sheikh. It was a really, really insightful and enlightening conversation, and getting to know the bad side of too much technology. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having this conversation with me.
You know, I especially like that part where she slid in a pun and spoke of viral misinformation. It's like a great double entendre.
Yeah. I like the part where she, you know, I always do think that these fake news, I mean, in India, we have seen a lot of, even before the pandemic, there was an instance where a fake news that was spread through WhatsApp led to mob lynchings in a lot of parts of India. So I used to think that it's just this one message or one forward that, you know, motivates people to take these steps. When I spoke to Dr. Sheikh, she actually told me that that's not the case entirely, because the fake news that, or fake message that goes through WhatsApp, is just the last step in something that has been happening many, many months or years before that. And then it has a lot to do with personal trauma and personal issues and those kind of things. So I really liked how she brought that aspect of, you know, how technology can be weaponized and it can inspire a certain section of the people to commit heinous crimes, you know, and how you can't just blame purely the technology for that. There are a lot of other societal issues also which sort of bubble up in this manner. So I think that was interesting for me.
Yeah. Do you see that India has learned from that the society has learned from that, and that it won't continue in this direction?
I really doubt that, because if you look at the kind of propaganda that is spread through, you know, all these WhatsApp groups, Telegram groups, through YouTube, it's very difficult to say that it's going to stop anytime soon. I think what's critical in India is digital literacy, because a lot of people, a lot of educated people as well, it's not like, you know, these fake news are spread by people who are completely uneducated. A lot of people who are very well educated, a lot of our family members sometimes don't read through an entire message and just believe something and forward it. So, but people are not very well aware of the algorithms and all, and how these social media works, you know, and it's, you can't really expect that to everyone to become aware of it overnight. So I think it's a process which will take some time. But I'm glad that initiatives like All New Science and, you know, what Dr. Sheikh is trying to do are showing some sort of results, like especially with the younger generation, where, you know, they have
these sessions in schools and educational institutions, and there's a lot more dialogue happening about the ills of spreading stuff without verifying it yourself. So I think it's a process. It'll take time.
Okay, thank you, Nimish, for recording these interviews and bringing us these perspectives. Thank you to our listeners for joining in and for following us on our social media channels, on Instagram at Record of Change, and on other platforms you'll find us as well.
Yes, I'm like super excited about this new season because it's a whole new approach to our podcast, and we would really like it if you guys, our listeners, give us some feedback and at least, you know, give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. That will really help us.
Yeah, let us know what you think, and talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.